I think we're close enough to 8 o'clock now. Most people are just coming in, followed in. Very good. So to continue on with the teachings of meditation, just keep to those teachings first of all. And one thing which I learned even before I became a monk about meditation was just the purpose of the meditation was not to be concentrated, because of those many years realizing that concentration was just counterproductive, it was stressful, and it never gave you much peace or happiness. And it took a while until I started learning Pali and understanding just the different versions and translations of these Pali texts, and even the Sanskrit and the Chinese versions. And it became quite apparent that the word for meditation is never meant to be concentration, it's stillness. The word for samadhi, the eighth factor, the eightfold path, is stillness. And it was something which, you know, my teachers would always impress upon me. And Ajahn Chah's simile, which, you know, he would use very, very often, he would actually put up his hand and he would wave it backwards and forwards. Many of you have seen me do this before. Wave it up, backwards and forwards, and he said, "This represents a leaf on a tree. And it only is moving because something outside of it is causing it to move. It is the wind." And he said, "If the wind stops, then the leaf will keep moving, but less and less and less, until it will become perfectly still, because that's its natural state. What we call these days a default state, to be still. It's only when something outside of it makes it move that you see it sort of fluttering." And he said, "The leaf represents the human mind, and it only moves because of something outside of it, which is called the wind of wanting something. And if you want something, that would always, like blowing on a leaf, it would always make the mind move. No matter what it is you want, good stuff, bad stuff, anything, it makes the mind move." So Ajahn Chah was always talking about, you know, stopping this wanting, letting go, leaving it alone. And of course, you know, that's what you read in the suttas as well, from the Buddha, you know, this second noble truth. It's the wanting is the cause of suffering. Third noble truth, letting go of wanting, leads to nibbana. So that was very helpful, but then again, you had to get your own simile. And my own simile, which again, many of you see me doing before. So my attendant today is Venerable Niwato, so to get him to do something, are you an honest monastic?
Yes, I am.
Very good. Will you just say that because I ask you to, or will you actually say the truth in spite of what I want you to say?
I will say despite what you want me to say.
Excellent. So you see, he's honest and courageous. So now you have to look at this glass of water, this cup of water. I am now going to hold this water perfectly still. So, has it stopped moving yet?
No, it hasn't moved.
Why? It's because I'm not paying no attention. So now be mindful. Has it stopped moving yet?
No, it hasn't.
Why? Because I'm not putting any effort in. I'm not concentrating. So now I will concentrate. Now, I really am trying to hold this still, honestly. What's happening?
It's still moving, Ajahn.
It's moving, even though you try. to hold it still. You cannot be done. The reason is because, you know, the muscles, you know, in your arm are always moving. It's just the nature of the anatomy of the human body. So how can I get this water to be perfectly still? Even just being aware and concentrating, that doesn't really work. It just makes me tired and frustrated. Fortunately, you had great teachers who taught me how to keep this water perfectly still. It's called letting go, detaching, not grasping, just putting it down. And that's so easy to do. Now, definitely, you're not just saying that, are you? Because I'm your teacher.
No, it's not moving anymore.
It's not moving. There we go. Proof. But that's a good simile, because we always in our life always think we have to do something to get somewhere. And that is a problem. Too much doing stuff, and we just get disappointed and frustrated. You can get so far, you can hold this water, and just with a lot of practice, you know, you put a lot of time and effort in, you can probably hold it pretty still, but never as still as when you put it down and let it go. Now that's a really weird thing to know, but that's actually how these things work. To get the mind still, you have to learn how to let it go. And it takes some patience. So what sometimes people do, they say, okay, yep, we let it go. Is it still yet? Well, not yet. Still yet? Come on, I haven't got all day. Come on, still. In other words, you have to give it some time to be patient for that stillness to happen. Now, of course, that when we start meditating on a retreat like this, people do the letting go meditation. They just, okay, just be in the moment, let this moment be, open the door of your heart to all moments. You know what happens? They fall asleep. Now, for many years, I always thought that was a great human failing, falling asleep. Especially in the early mornings, and in Wat Pa Phong, in northeast Thailand, that every morning we get up at 3 o'clock, and I say, and this was true, it was optional. You could always get up before 3 a.m. if you wanted to, but not afterwards. And I was only trying to sleep 4 hours a day. And I managed to get it down to 4.5, but I couldn't get underneath 4.5. And so you get up in the morning, you know, haven't slept very much, and it was in an environment which was really hot and humid. It was in the jungles. And, you know, we were malnourished. You know, we have photos of me in Thailand, and you just see how thin I was, because just the case that there wasn't really much good food there at all, hardly any food. And even the rice was just such poor soil, it wasn't sort of all that nutritious. So that, you know, malnourished, you were tired in a climate you weren't accustomed to. And of course, you know, you felt sleepy. And I know that some of the experiences you had, that sometimes, you know, that we had to do our visas and renew the visas once a year in Bangkok. So I remember going to Bangkok. And in Bangkok, even when you go on arms round, you get really good food, much better than what you get in the northeast. And in this monastery I was staying just for a few days to do the visas, they had one of the first monasteries which had an air-conditioned room. And no one would use it in that monastery at 3 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, we asked for the key, yeah, fine. So we could have that room for ourselves from 3 to about 5 o'clock where we started our arms round. Aircon. And it was amazing. All my sloth and torpor totally vanished. But it was nice and cool and had a good lunch and a good sleep the night before. I was fresh, alert, and meditation was just so easy. And it's sort of, come on, you stupid monk. It's not me. It's not my failings. It was just supporting conditions weren't really conducive to getting that meditation going. And, you know, it's no disrespect to the Buddha, but if the Buddha had been born in England, He would have probably been sleepy in the morning. It's just cause and effect. It's nothing to do with you. But before I realized that, you put forth effort in. And you did have a lot of effort when I needed to get it going. And sometimes you would just sit there and really just forcefully try and hold the mind onto the breathing. It was such hard work. Sometimes you'd overcome the sloth and torpor, the sleepiness. But what would happen afterwards? I'd be restless, couldn't stop thinking. And so calm the thinking down, calm it down, and you fall asleep again. And for me it was just this pendulum between sloth and torpor and restlessness. And it was so hard to find that middle way. As soon as you calmed yourself down, you fell asleep. As soon as you forced yourself out of sleep, you know, you were restless again. And after a while, you know, trying to fight it, that just did not work. You decided to follow what your teacher was saying all the time, let go. So what you did, you fell asleep. I had a little bit of mindfulness there, but mindfulness was making sure that you weren't trying to control it or fight it. It was nature. So you just were there, not fighting. Just being aware, being as still, as peaceful as you possibly could. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. Which you see on some people's t-shirts here. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. So that's all I would do. And a strange thing happened, unexpected. At first, until you understand how this mind works and what the Buddha kept on teaching you and Ajahn Chah kept repeating, when you just let it go, you'd find that quite naturally the sloth and torpor would start to vanish. It would just dissipate gradually and it would start fading away. You start to become more alert. And weird things happen, such as, you know, your head was bowed down like that, and then it would straighten up all by itself. And I didn't do that. I was just letting things be. The body straightened itself up. Just like anyone who knows anything about medicine knows, most of the body is autonomous. You don't decide, you know, just know how much blood to pump around, it just does it automatically. If it's needed, it does it. So, you know, this body is, you know, way ahead of Google, driverless cars. It's been doing this, but we think we're doing it, and a lot of times all we do is actually interfere. So, the body strains up by itself, and you start to become clear. You can actually be aware, and you can become aware of your breath, but without effort. It was a natural process. And it was from that where I developed it's a powerful teaching about mindfulness, that mindfulness is not what you make happen. You don't force mindfulness. It's not something you develop through energy, through effort, through willpower. In fact, it's the willpower which drains the mindfulness of its energy. Instead, we learn how to put things down, let it go. And when we put things down and let it go, what happens is the energy of our mind, instead of being wasted with doing things, controlling, struggling, wriggling, instead of being wasted, that energy starts to flowing into knowing, into mindfulness. You literally start to wake up. And it's a natural clarity, a natural energy. Just like I never told my body to straighten up, it did it by itself. So the mind became clear by itself when I stopped interfering. And just let the mind just wake up. Because, I read this in some article just a couple of weeks ago, about 20% of your energy, of all the fuel you take in with the rice and the teas and the whatever else you put in your mouth, all that energy, 20% of that is used by your brain. It's not a very big organ, but it certainly uses up a disproportionate amount of your fuel supply, which actually shows you just how much we think and how much energy this thing up here actually just chews up. And you can imagine just what would happen if that brain wasn't using up so much of that energy, that you were still not fighting, not planning, not being anxious. Imagine what would happen. It means all that energy has to go somewhere, and it goes into knowing, into mindfulness. You become more and more and more aware, more awake. Instead of moving through a mist, you have clarity. Instead of even just being in the dullness of the early morning, it's like bright sunshine. Everything is illuminated. You feel, you see, you hear, you know, because the mindfulness is enhanced. And I'm going to be saying much about that later on in this retreat, but that strengthening of mindfulness is one of the great benefits and joys of this meditation. Because you will notice, and you don't know when this is happening, it will just be something which will happen during this retreat, that the food begins to taste more delicious. It's already pretty nice, but you ain't seen nothing yet. It starts to get really tasty, and you can actually start to appreciate the beautiful forests. Even a little flower, or the birds, you can really hear them. It's like your senses have been cleared, of all the dust and grime, which stops it being alive, alert. And what happens is you are becoming mindful, really aware. You can actually see and feel things. And strangely, what you see, what you hear, what you taste and feel becomes surprisingly pleasant, joyful, happy. And that happiness is not inherent, in the food or in the sound of the birds. It's just what we add to it with our clarity of mindfulness. The simile, I repeat similes because you've only got so many similes and you choose the best, which are most relevant. And that is, I think about 35 years in this place. 1983 we came here, December, so almost 35 years since we've moved up into this hillside here, this monastery. And for 7 years, roughly, 6 years, maybe 8 years, but quite a while, I'd always gone up and down Kingsbury Drive in a vehicle. Because you're really busy. And even now, sometimes, even if I say, I will walk, they'll say, no, we'll give you a lift, but I need the exercise. And they say, but I need the merit more than you need the exercise. That's very tough. So anyway, and this time I insisted. It was a beautiful morning. I was early. And so I insisted walking up the hill from the very bottom, Southwest Highway, up to the monastery. So it's about 2.2 kilometers. Not that far, but quite a steep hill. And I had plenty of time, not conquering the mountain, just enjoying a nice walk in the morning. And I was walking up. A strange experience happened. I've been living here for about 7 years at a time, and I could not recognize the surroundings. It was so totally different from what I remembered looking through the window of a speeding car. I could see so much more, and it looked far more delightful. And it was so weird. Why was this happening? Why was I just seeing that hillside so beautiful for the first time? But I stopped. I stopped and just stared. And then it changed again. And not just all in one flash, but it just grew in just the amount of detail which I could see. I always say just the bark of the trees, just how they weren't sort of smooth, that they were I think it's called tessellated, just little cracks, fissures in the bark. And just every piece of bark had a different shade. And the grass just was incredibly beautiful, like shining, like fluorescent in the sunshine. And thousands, millions of blades of grass, and they all stood out. And right in the very bottom of the valley, the stream was still running, and it was just delightful. It was glittering like diamonds in the bottom of the valley. And the stones and the rocks, it was like it was landscaped. And everything looked so incredibly delightful and so much detail. I stood there in awe. I'd seen that many times before, I thought, but now I was like seeing it for the first time. What was the difference? So, now, part of being a Buddhist, now, is not just accepting things, but challenging them and just reflecting on them using sort of logic, cause and effect, science. And it soon became quite clear, and this was a simile which I developed, when it's just the nature of sight. When you see an object, you know, in your eye, is a chemical reaction on your retina. And that chemical reaction takes a time. It's not instantaneous. And it takes a while for those signals to actually to go through your optic nerves into your brain and get worked out. But what was happening when I was looking through the window of a speeding car, you get an image, and then another image, and then another image, and then another image. The images were following one another so fast that not one of them was fully formed. In other words, you had sort of like a pastel colors, not much detail because it was just too fast. But when I stopped, got out of the car and just walked, sorry, when I walked out of the car, going slower, you could see more detail and the colors were richer. And when you stopped and stared perfectly still, then just the anatomy of the eye, the way that sight works, you had enough time in the world to have a sight and allow it to fully form, to fully open up without moving on to something else. So all the, like instead of a green swathe of grass, it was individual little blades of grass. And they were just incredibly beautiful. Instead of being a washed out colour, if they were really enhanced. And that became a very helpful simile for how the stillness, the going slow, not forcing things, not rushing, really assists in the meditative process. By going more slowly, taking time, becoming still, you find your senses can actually pick up so much more of, you know, what you eat, what you feel in your body, what you see, and also what you know in your mind. And unexpected, I never expected that hillside to look so gorgeous and so beautiful. And just your mind, even like something like the breathing, becomes incredibly beautiful. Weird, but absolutely true, because of the stillness. And there comes a time in the meditation where the breath becomes so delightful, you don't have to put any effort at all into watching it. You just can't take your eyes off the beautiful breath. Now, I'm talking about the mental eyes, your awareness, your mindfulness, because it's delightful. And you will all experience that sooner or later. You'll be sitting here with a nice smile on your face, just watching the breath come in. Ah, yeah, breath go out. Oh, yeah. Oh, I can take more of this. Oh, yeah. Breathing in. Oh, yeah. Breathing out. Wow. Now, some people think there must be something wrong with that. No. One of the great monks, he came to spend a range retreat here many, many, many years ago. And that was still alive. That's Ajahn Gunha. Some of you have been to see him. And he was the one, because we have our resident snake was spotted the other day. Very hard to spot the fellow. He just, you know, is pretty shy. He's a recluse. Comes here to meditate, not to bite anybody. So a little snake. But this monk, you know, over time, he lived with snakes all over the place. I remember this one, I'm going off on other stories. We were doing this little ceremony. It's a fortnightly chanting of the rules, the Patimokkha. And I was doing it that day. I was doing the chanting. And one of the other monks, you know, all the monks were sitting sort of around because they have to sort of, you know, listen carefully. And on the back of this monk, that's right, it's on his left side, a little head appeared. It was a snake that just crawled up his back while we were doing the chanting. And there was, it would be wonderful if you could have those YouTube videos. You know, the time when you could really make use of them, they weren't there at all because it was a long time ago. But it was a surreal moment because the snake came up, and of course I stopped the chanting because, you know, the snake, and the snake sort of turned around to the monk, and the monk turned around to the snake, and they were eyeballing one another, wondering what to do next. It was a crazy moment. And the monk just very gently just put his robe down so the snake could fall off very gently and just would slither away. So the snake's all over the place. But this was in the jungle. And in the jungle, this Ajahn Gunha was sitting with many other monks when a king cobra came. Now, king cobras, they are big, dangerous snakes. Some of them have got attitude, as I used to say. So, and I was told, and actually the first thing I was told about snakes in Thailand, just, you know, to make sure you were careful of them, there were 100 species of snakes, and that's an approximation. It said 99 are venomous. If they bite you, you're in trouble. And the 100th one strangles you to death. Thank you, very reassuring. But they were okay, they just got used to them after a while. But this king cobra was nicknamed One Step Snake. And I said, why do you call it that? And he says, because if it bites you, that's all you've got to live. Really venomous, that's what they say. Probably an exaggeration, but, you know, make you careful of them. But they certainly are just pretty dangerous. And so this snake came right up to Ajahn Gunha and lifted up its hood. And you know, Ajahn Gunha had his eyes open. All the other monks were like, you know, what should we do? Lifted up its hood. Right in front of his nose. That is a true story. Monks saw this. And of course, no video, but right in front. What could you do? Sitting down, cross-legged like this, you know, you can't just jump up and run away. So what would you do? Even if you did run away, one of the most scariest things about snakes in Thailand, when you did see them run or swim. I saw these snakes swim. I never saw a snake swim before, and it was really fast. Now, I don't know, Ian Thorpe, he was the Australian swimmer, he wouldn't have no chance against a snake. Get the gold medal in him at the same time. But they're really fast, and the snakes running, when they want to run, the bigger the snake, the faster they are. It was amazing to watch. But anyway, and this is through the jungle, over sticks and obstacles, amazing. But anyway, hear this, so what would you do? So what this monk did, Ajahn Gunha, he lifted up his hand and patted the snake on the head, saying, oh, thank you for coming to visit me. Now could you do that? Please don't try with our snake. This was a special monk. He patted him on the head like that. And what did the snake do? Oh, the snake loved every moment. It's really rare to have your head patted, especially if you're a snake. You know, people just don't like you. They're afraid of you. And they don't realize you just want a nice little pat on the head, that's all, because it's so rare. So he pat him on the head for a couple of minutes, and then the snake sort of put in his hood and went to see another monk. No way, no way, go back to him. I'm not doing that. But later on, when Ajahn Gunhar came to stay with us, that's when we had our plans in to build the meditation hall over in Bodhinyana. And I would invite you that if you have meditation is not that hot over here, you know, you're getting a bit of trouble, try the Bodhinyana hall. It's really good energy there, especially go towards the front. So that's open for you as well if you want to meditate in Bodhinyana meditation hall. But we had the plans for that, hadn't been approved yet, so the mayor, who was our neighbour, lived down the hill, Mr. Kentish, he came to check us out. And he was the mayor of Serpentine Jamadal Council. And he was like a farmer, typical Australian. His belly was bigger than mine. And he was wearing a suit and a tie. But, you know, those buttons would actually come off any time. It's just really sort of hard to keep them tight. And that's the important part of the story, because when I saw him come, he didn't, you know, make an announcement he was coming. He turned up, I knew he was. Who went to see him first of all? Ajahn Gunhar. And Ajahn Gunhar couldn't speak any English. The mayor couldn't speak any Thai. Ajahn Gunhar went right up to him with a big smile on his face and started patting his belly. Now, that is not culturally appropriate in Australia. You don't go around patting somebody's belly, even especially if it's the mayor. And I saw that, and I was trying to stop him, but I wasn't fast enough. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's it. No plans for us anymore. We've lost everything. But it was a wonderful time because you saw Ajahn this mayor. He was actually, his smile, and he was like gurgling like a baby. He loved every minute of it. And we got our plans. Look, if that person could pat a snake, he can pat a man. No worries at all. And he became really a good friend, good old Clem Kentish. So we had no problems with the Shire. But that was where was I going with this? I was going with, I forget where I started now, anyways. Sorry, snakes. And patting them. And mindfulness, yeah. Okay, anyway, nice fun.
What would you do if the snake was there?
Yeah, you would do that. So you were paying about as much attention as I was. Oh yeah, coming up here. So, yeah, so you get used to the snakes anyway, partner. Ah, that's the one, yes. Very good. I'm glad that somebody is paying attention. I got an excuse, I'm old. But how he taught meditation, Ajahn Gunhar, you know, he was here, and obviously a really great monk, teach meditation, he was hardly say anything. All he would say is, breathe in, sabah. And he would really, you know, put a lot of emotion into the word sabai. Sabai is a Thai word. If you ever go to Thailand, that's all you really need to know, the word sabah. It means nice, easy, beautiful, joyful. So you breathe in, sabah. Breathe out, oh, sabah. And that's what he taught. He's a very, very famous monk now, over in Thailand. Great monk. And you could see why. Simple, the delightful breath. How can you do that? It comes quite naturally after a while. You get so much joy, so much beauty, so much delight, and just simple things, just like watching the breath. Ah, nice. Breathe out. It's one of the reasons why it's hard to get on these retreats. Why? because the reputation's around. It's not just because it's lax or sloppy. It's because actually you get something out of this, something unexpected. The joyful meditations, how easy it is to keep still. And from the stillness, this actually grows. The stillness is not a static state. Things happen once you are still. To understand why, basic science, and part of my upbringing and experience as a meditator. When I was 21, 22, I went up to the north of England, because my girlfriend was up there, and there was a retreat on. It's very hard to do any retreats at all. So any place there was a retreat on, you'd go. And this was a Zen retreat. And the Zen retreat, never been on a Zen retreat before, pretty scary because, you know, the guide comes behind you, you know, with the Zen stick. But, and I was sleepy in the morning. It was cold. It was north of England. It was freezing. And I always had really good karma in my life. Very, very fortunate. Must have done some really nice things in previous lives. So what happened? I was sleepy, but the man sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he got hit first with the Zen stick. Whack! And it's amazing how that cured my sleepiness. I was alert all morning, and the next morning too. Just fear. It wasn't really good at all. That was just tension. But now later on in the afternoon, hardly had any instructions at all. Didn't know what to do. They didn't say just sit. You had to keep your eyes open. You're facing a wall. That's all. And just be careful of the guy with the stick. But anyway. But I'd done enough meditation before to know how just to let go, to relax, be in the present moment, to don't think so much. And so you're sitting there just watching this wall, this whitewashed wall, 10, 15 minutes. And then the wall disappeared. And that was so cool. You're sitting there, eyes open, watching a wall, and it wasn't there anymore. Now, 60s, 70s, the drug time, the hippie time, anything weird was really cool. So you weren't afraid. Instead, you were thinking, wow, this is neat. This is amazing. Something's happening. You know that sometimes in meditation, weird things happen. Don't be afraid. You're missing out. It's great stuff. You're totally safe. In all the years I've taught here, never had any casualties yet. So you're perfectly safe. I've got a good record. But when it was weird, I just let it happen. I thought, wow, this is great. Why? That walking up the hillside, why can I see so much now? Why has a wall disappeared? And it wasn't that hard to figure out, but it opened up a nice insight into just how meditation works. And that stillness is not a static state. It leads into incredible other states. Because your brain is wired to notice things which change. If things stay static, they vanish. You know that. Just need to close your eyes. First, when you close your eyes, you see the inside of your eyelids. And after a few seconds, nothing's happening, the brain turns off. The saliva in your throat. Now you've got to swallow it. It's a problem. But after a few minutes, it doesn't really change that much. It will vanish. You won't be aware of it anymore. Even the sound of the aircon in the morning. Or the afternoon, whenever it's on. That after a while, you don't hear it anymore. Because it's just the nature of the brain. It's just very efficient. If it doesn't change, you don't notice it anymore. It turns off. So similar to mobile devices. If you don't press a button, a switch, you don't click the mouse, the screen turns off. That's what happens with the senses. All of them. But to start off with the sight, I was watching a wall, and that's all I was paying attention to. I wasn't fantasizing or dreaming or planning. And after a while, it just vanished. Sight turned off. And that taught me how stillness works. And the first important part of comfort. You're reasonably comfortable in your body, and after a while, you can't feel the body anymore. That's called going to sleep at night time. If you've got aches and pains or something, just as long as they don't really change too much, it disappears. So you can, the senses will turn off. So that's why you don't have to have it perfectly silent. As long as it's reasonably quiet, the place where you're meditating, the senses of sound, hearing, sight, taste, smell, physical touch is one of the hardest to turn off. That's why it's difficult to get into a good position. And even if you are in a good position, there's something which is always moving. Just first came to Perth so many years ago. I was staying in a small little house in Magnolia Street, and this was a time when somebody came to see us and they said, oh, we've just imported the first flotation tank into Australia. And this was these sensory deprivation chambers where you would float, and it was in water which was at your salty water, so you'd actually float it, not being submerged, but just be able to float in it. It was at your body temperature, so you couldn't even really feel it. And it was soundproof, and obviously had some flow of air in there so you could breathe. So there was, and it was totally dark, so there's no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, and actually totally physically comfortable. There's no pressure anywhere on your body, just floating in these tanks. And so I was really keen. Oh, this will make it really easy to meditate. But I was number two. We have hierarchies. So because of that I had to wait my turn, and the senior monk, the Ajahn Chacko, he got the first shot at it. And the next morning, he went on one morning, and the next morning they got the newspaper, the local newspaper, the West Australian. There's a big article. Flotation tanks, as used by Buddhist monks. He tricked us, he conned us into going there so he could put, without our permission, put on his advertisement as how we used it to meditate. And so because we were conned, we were tricked, sort of, he wouldn't let me go in it. I was really disappointed. We've already been tricked. We've got damage is always done. You know, you can't. I was really looking forward to that. Life is full of disappointments. But anyway, I asked him, what was it like in there? Was it really peaceful? He said, oh, yeah, you know, it was just no impingement on your sight, no any external sounds, really comfortable. But, he said, when I was in there, there was this huge sound which I couldn't shut down. You're breathing. Because everything else was taken away, that was really prominent. And so, it really taught me that when everything else vanishes because of stillness, your breath appears. It's the only thing left which is moving. So what we're doing here, reasonably still until your body starts to vanish. That's why you do this relaxation to begin with. Not thinking of the past or the future, being kind to it until that vanishes. And what you'll be aware of naturally, whether you seek for it or not, is the breathing. When the rest of the the rest of the body vanishes, there's no other impingements. The breathing is there. But what happens with the breath, because it just is prominent all by itself, whether you choose to watch it or not, is that because you are not doing very much, if anything, especially you're not thinking, planning, controlling, striving, because you're not using energy, the brain doesn't need to metabolize so much, which means that you don't need so much air. The self-regulating system called your body breathes in less and less and less. not because you force it or you want it, because it's total nature. So you're breathing in so lightly. At the same time, because the mindfulness is increasing, you're not using mental energy, the breath starts to appear beautiful. It's breathing in, breathing out. That's where it comes from, the delightful breath. Now, what do you do next? Stupid question. There is no next. Present moment awareness, the power of now, just being here. Why is it that it's starting to become stillness? Okay, more still, please. Come on, I want more, 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 more. You're interfering with the process. So just be with a delightful breath. But I'm not getting anywhere. Oh, yes, you are. Wait in the stillness. Because nothing much is moving. So, just like the wall disappears, your breath disappears. Ooh, that's interesting. And don't think, I'm not breathing, I'm going to die. You don't die. I think Bianca's been cooking on all these retreats. No one has ever died on this retreat. No, I'm not jinxing it, no way. So, you are not going to pass away, because this is natural. The breath starts to get so light, you don't notice it anymore. Still, you know, doing it very lightly, but, you know, it's not part of your consciousness. Because it's still, it vanishes. So what's left? Then you get the joy coming up. Remember, I Want Happiness on the wall there, that cartoon I found, I put it on the wall in the kitchen. No I, no wants, and happiness. And it doesn't stop like that, it just gets deeper and deeper. The joy of the mind. That's where it starts getting these beautiful lights in the mind. They happen by themselves. Don't go looking for them. Don't go trying to grab hold of them. This is nimitta land, and it just happens by itself. Just leave it alone until those nimittas become really bright and incredibly beautiful. And when I get to these nimittas, and people are always, they really pay attention. I can look at your faces now. Oh yeah, we're interested in this. No more jokes. This is the real stuff. Craving, wanting. So it doesn't work if you want things. It just happens naturally. You just relax, be still, allow it to happen. And when it does happen, it becomes incredibly powerful and beautiful. Really sort of big amounts of joy. So well, isn't this indulging? It's not indulging. You learn so much from this. Remember I said, I think, yesterday, now, people want to get enlightened, but do you really know what enlightenment is? Like getting on a bus, not knowing what the destination is. One of the most beautiful descriptions by the Buddha of enlightenment is paramang sukhang. No, paramang is the same word as paramount. The ultimate happiness, joy. The more you get close to this, the more joy you have. And the insight is, well, why is that joyful? Because you've let go of a huge amount of suffering. Your body. How can you get it to be nice and peaceful and happy? Exercise, eating. After a while, you know, it just doesn't matter what you eat. It does, but you exercise, yeah, but it still lets you down. But you're never as happy and as free as when this body vanishes. Oh, what joy that is. Freedom. You know that, what story? Okay, I'm told the mosquito story. Mosquitoes in Northeast Thailand, again, 42 years ago. The first time in that part of the jungle. Well, there was jungle in those days, as I say, snakes and jungle stuff there, but there was these mosquitoes, the very first time they'd met Western monks, Western food. And they would. I don't know why Ajahn Chah did this. Sometimes they did this on purpose, you know. There's other ways to get enlightened instead of this torture business. So, starting at Wat Nana Cha, I was one of the first 6 monks who went there, and Ajahn Chah did, you know, give it a bit of a boost. He would come every evening for the first couple of months, and we would sit meditation for 2 hours under the trees, and then he'd do a bit of chanting, give a Dharma talk, he would go back. Starting about 6 p.m. Exactly the time, 6 p.m., when the mosquitoes would come out for their dinner. And that was us, the monks. But you know, I'd look at the Thai monks, and they weren't getting bitten, it's just the Western monks were. Really unfair. And you're asking for some, can we have some mosquito calls? No. Can we have some repellent? No. Can we have some screens? No. So we were just sitting there being devoured. And it was actually that monk I said last night who had the premonitions of being shot by the Viet Cong coming over the border. It was with him, because he was, I was only about a couple of weeks senior to him, so we sat next to each other. So we'd play the game to count how many mosquitoes we could count at one time on our arms and head. And it's no exaggeration. No, honest, it's not one of those fisherman stories. The fish was this big, but it was only this big. It was about 60 or 70 at one time. And you could not sort of, if there was some after that, get too close together, you couldn't sort of distinguish them. And that was just really, really irritating. Many times you'd open your eyes and want to run away, and you see, Ajahn Chah was there. If he wasn't there, I would have run away. And there was also the pride, the Western pride. All these Thai monks, they were just sitting there. Nothing was happening to them. They weren't running away. Well, if they can do it, I can do it. But anyway, it's just really tough. So after a few days, you really learnt to do what we call focusing. I'll maybe have the time to say this. What it means is the same as the simile of a screen. Whatever you put on the centre of the screen is maintained. What's on the edge of the screen eventually falls off the screen. So I made sure the breath was at the centre of the screen. Yeah, the mosquitoes really irritated, but they were on the edge, on the outside. And so after a little while, this you were just with the breath. Just very beautiful, delightful, and just going inside. So you couldn't feel the mosquitoes. And it was really weird. A couple of hours sit after you had to do this, do it properly. After a bit of focusing, just the body vanished. Oh, that was just so wonderful. Not to be bitten by mosquitoes, or if you were, you didn't really know it, and you didn't care because you were inside, instead of feeling this irritating. But when I came out afterwards, it was really weird because as a Westerner, when you get bitten by a mosquito, you get a little bump come up, a little welt. And usually after meditating, you're covered in them. But there's nothing there at all. And I thought, wow, the psychic power of meditation, the force field which keeps off mosquitoes. And that's what I really thought at the time. It was only later on you found out that it was not sort of anything other than basic science, that mosquitoes are attracted to carbon dioxide coming out of your pores, mostly. That's what gets them close to you. And the more you worry, the more agitated you are, the more you metabolize, the more you breathe. In other words, the more restless and agitated you are, the more carbon dioxide comes out. So the more worried you are, the more they know where to find you. But when you get very peaceful and calm and quiet, in a deep meditation, you're probably hardly metabolizing at all. So the mosquitoes, they couldn't find me. And they sort of bit the monks next to me instead. Not a very much of a good bodhisattva. But you just get very peaceful. And that's how these things work. So the main purpose of this talk this evening is to, this morning, is to emphasize that when you are still, you don't just fall asleep. It's not static. It's not sort of a place where you don't make any progress at all. It may sound counterintuitive, but the more still you are, the deeper you go in, and the more you actually progress. Stillness is the path. Because when things become still, they disappear. When they disappear, you see what's inside of it. That becomes still, and that disappears. And that becomes still, and that disappears. It's a simile of the thousand-petal lotus. I'll only say that in brief, and I'll probably do more about that tomorrow, because it's a great simile which also describes many of the stages of meditation and how they open up by themselves through that stillness. Thousand-petal lotus, the outer petal of the lotus, very dirty, very rough, very coarse, not fragrant, not beautiful at all. The light and warmth of the sun hit it in the early morning, allowing the outermost petal to open up so the light and warmth of the sun can strike the first layer of petals inside. So they open up. So the light and warmth of the sun can reach the second layer of petals. So they open up. So that light and the warmth of the sun can reach the third layer of petals. So it opens up stage by stage. That lotus. And the deeper you go into the lotus, the more fragrant, the more beautiful, the more subtle are those layers of petals. And that lotus is you. And to open up the lotus, the warmth and light of the sun stands for the kindness and the mindfulness. Kindness and the mindfulness relaxes the body, allows it to sort of become so comfortable it vanishes. Time. Being kind to your past and your future, softening it, and it vanishes. You come to the present moment. Being kind to the present moment, being aware of it, and it opens up. But usually inside the present moment, that's where you find the breath. What do? Just be kind, be aware, mindful of this breath, and it becomes a full awareness of the breath. From the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. Beginning of an out-breath to the end of an out-breath, full awareness of the breathing. And then just being kind, being aware, and the breath starts to slow down and become very fine and very, very calm. And then you just be aware, be kind, and then the breath becomes beautiful, the delightful breaths. And you keep on going like that, nimittas. Just being aware, being, because I'm right in the middle of the delightful breath, the nimitta comes out. Just being aware, being kind, the nimitta just grows in intensity. Being aware, being kind, it becomes so still and powerful, this nimitta, it vanishes, and inside you find the jhanas. All these times, it's like layers of petals opening up by being kind, by being aware. Stillness opens things out. So that's why that stillness is such a powerful word. Even, it's even got into the Christian Bible in Psalms. You know what it says in there? Be still and know that thou art God. That's what it says in there. It's not sort of theistic stuff. But if you get into some of those deep meditations, my goodness, if you're a Christian, they make you a saint. So this is what would happen. So beautiful, so powerful. You're not there. That's what it feels like. So, stillness, samadhi. And stillness is a cause for seeing things as they truly are. The last little simile. If you go and sit by the lake, if there is any waves on the surface of that lake, a wind or a little duck sort of swimming in it or whatever, you can't get a true reflection of the sky, of the stars, maybe the moon. It's a waste, quite a bit of a while since the moon comes out. The moon is actually waxing, it's growing now. When's the next full moon? That's the next 31st, just at the end of the retreat. full moon day. So it's growing. But later on in the retreat, if you go down at night time and the moon is out, it's only if the lake is perfectly still without a ripple that you can actually see the true reflection. That's why in many watercolours I always like to see the moon reflected in a still lake. Just like the stillness of the mind. Only that can reflect the Dhamma without any distortion. That's why stillness is a cause for seeing things as they truly are. Da da da. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.